When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
This week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make super smart decisions about your financial life. First, here's my Glinkonomics report. This week, it seems appropriate to do a quick review of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's new TILA-RESPA, or TRID, mortgage disclosure policies. Now, these changes just took effect on October 3rd, and they're intended to protect consumers when they obtain a mortgage by requiring that the bank disclosures be made in a new format and mandating a three-day waiting period for consumers to review the information before signing loan documents. Which sounds amazing, right? Now, real estate professionals are probably going to feel the impact the most, but there are a couple of things that homebuyers should prepare for, particularly over the next few weeks as this all gets implemented. First, you may find that your closing takes longer than it used to. That's largely because of the mandated waiting period I mentioned, which is why some lenders are pushing out closing dates. But additional delays may pile up if realtors have any trouble adjusting to the new process. And the good news is from the reports I'm hearing, well, I should say lack of reports I'm hearing, things seem to be progressing pretty well. There have been a few hiccups here and there, but we're not seeing like massive numbers of closings go up in flames. So that's good news. The other good news for real estate pros is that the grace period for getting these changes right is probably going to be extended through the end of the year. So delays are the worst penalty that anyone is likely to experience related to TRID before 2016 and probably well into 2016. The second thing that homebuyers need to know is that you could run into trouble if you want to change the terms of your loan once you reach the closing table, because it could trigger another waiting period. And that may affect your mortgage rate lock if you're not careful. Now, that said, if you see an error in your documents, for sure you should raise your hand and get it fixed, because once you sign the loan docs, you're done, right? You've signed on. So be very careful. Read the loan docs. But my suggestion is to read them in advance of the closing. And if you don't understand what they mean, you should call your attorney, not the attorney that represents the bank that you're probably paying for, but your very own real estate attorney who can represent you in the closing process. Now, I got an email from Bankrate advising homebuyers to consider requesting an extended rate lock of either 45 or 60 days from their lender in order to avoid any problems with that. So that's something to explore with your loan officer, and there should be or may be a cost trade-off for it. So again, extending it out may cost you a little bit more, but it may be worth it so you don't blow the rate lock. But it's probably enough if you do your homework, again, before you submit your mortgage application so you don't wind up needing multiple revisions to your loan terms after getting the rate lock. When you get the documents, it'll be about between 3 and 7 days before your closing. That's the time that you should be reading it and making sure that everything that you agreed to that is on your docs that you got back from the lender when you did the application, that those are accurately reflected in the cover sheet, which is the summary pages of the new loan docs. Now, the TRID changes shouldn't be that big an issue for most homebuyers, so you should just talk to your realtor to be sure that he or she has a good handle on the process. And if they do, great. If they don't, it'll work out. All right, on to the rest of the show. My guest today is Jonathan Smoke. He's chief economist for Realtor.com. As I've promised, he and I will be discussing the September jobs report. Wow, that marked a U-turn in the wrong direction for the labor market. And as I keep saying, the employment conditions have a huge impact on the health of the housing market, right? Jobs equal real estate. Two jobs equals a home purchase. Jonathan and I go deep into that, so be sure to check out our conversation for his insight into what the employment numbers mean for the year ahead in real estate. And then I asked him about doomsday scenarios, so you're going to have to stick around for that. In my second segment, I answer a question from a listener about adding her daughter's name to the house title and deed. This is really a tax question, and it covers a few different types of taxes at that. So make sure you tune in for my advice to any homeowner looking to transfer part or all ownership in his or her home prior to a death. Once you, if you die and inherit, that's a whole other thing. Particularly, this is of issue if you've got a quick claim deed in your hot little hand and you're trying to think about what to do with it. Finally, I'm going to share five tips for selling your home quickly. And I might as well call this five tips for a happy home selling experience because you know, and I know for sure, that a quick sale saves a ton of stress. All right, that's the lineup for today's show. Let's get started. This week, my guest is Jonathan Smoke. He's chief economist at Realtor.com, and I invited him on the show this week because I want to have a conversation about last week's jobs report and about what's going on with the Fed. While the economy added fewer jobs than expected, the unemployment rate held steady at 5.1%, and even the U6, which, as all of you know, is my measure for sort of the broad rate of unemployment, that even dropped a bit down to 10%. But there seems to be a lot of slack in the labor market. It's not like your paycheck's increasing, is it? And you need look no further than actually there was a decrease in the average hourly wages in September. So I asked Jonathan to come on to share his take on the unemployment numbers, but also to talk about how these numbers could affect the real estate market. And then again, what the heck is going on with the Fed? Jonathan, welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks for having me, Elise.
All right, where do you want to start? There's so much to dig in. Jobs?
I think jobs is a very important place to start, and that September report was a blow. I would say that this has been the best year, clearly, we've seen in housing since the downturn. So 8 or 9 years, depending on what metric you're looking at. And I would argue what has been driving this has been the robust recovery in jobs and the very solid pace of job creation that we've been seeing, because there's a critical relationship between job creation and household formation. And in the absence of household formation, you don't really have fundamental demand for housing. And we saw in that report not only a disappointing number for September, but also a revision to August and July that essentially meant that our pace of job creation was down for the first time in almost a year. And that doesn't bode well for seeing the same kind of job creation and household demand over the next year that we've seen so far. So it was important to understand what's happening.
So what's interesting to me is that as we've looked back and we saw July and August be revised downward, we've also seen the number of homes sold, sort of the people who are putting houses under contract, right? So that future look, those had been dropping as well since the spring. It was kind of strong in January, February, March, and then all of a sudden we saw it kind of tailor off. And I'm wondering, clearly those two things are tied together. What do you think is going on with jobs, though?
Well, I think jobs is a reflection of the manufacturing sector and the energy sector both being weak this summer because of the increase in the value of the dollar, and that impacting exports, and of course the weakness in oil causing job declines in the energy sector. So I think that's principally what's happening there. In the grand scheme of themes, grand scheme of things in the economy, that's less than 10% of the U.S. economy. Housing actually plays a much more significant role to the economy, so we should be able to handle that. But to see the pace, we're seeing declines, right?
Right. Except that we're not, and even in new construction, which is where I think housing really gets the big boom, right? Which is when you have all these people building new houses and then the furnishing of the new houses, the sale of the new houses, that's still at only about half of where it should be. I mean, I think we're going to end up, it's definitely better. We're not at 300,000 like we were a few years ago, and we're not at 400,000 like we were last year, but are we going to actually crack 500,000 new homes sold? Maybe, but we should be at way closer to 1 million new homes sold. And when you're building and selling an extra 500,000 homes, I would imagine that's a pretty big jolt to the economy.
That's right. The biggest multiplier for the economy coming from housing is from new construction, and specifically into what you were just describing in single-family new construction, meaning we see a much higher multiplier coming from single-family homes versus apartments versus just sales of existing homes. So you're absolutely right. That's where we need to see the biggest increase, and we haven't. We've seen solid, consistent, gradual increases. This could be a year, if we end the year strong, that we finally see a double-digit increase year over year. But in recoveries past, you would have seen a 30 to 40% type of recovery, and that's just not materializing.
And the whole recovery thing anyway is kind of strange, right? Because technically the recession, the Great Recession, ended 2009. It ended in 2009,
right.
And now we're at 2015. We're 6 years out from the technical end of the recession. I would argue that for so many people, it's never ended. This is so now I want to move a little bit to how the world is doing, if you don't mind getting a little macro with me, or very macro, global. The whole issue with China and what China's growth, definitely slowing, how much it's slowing is a concern. The sort of the world angst that's going on with Syria, Russia, ISIS, how Asia is playing into that, versus the U.S., versus some of the other players that are kind of fighting ISIS. How does all of that slowing and kind of this political focus, and now we're getting into an election cycle, seriously into an election cycle, how is all of that going to affect real estate and the market and what the Fed is doing? Because I would have laid a dime to a dollar that the Fed would have raised interest rates this past cycle because they didn't want to get into next year in a presidential election cycle to start raising interest rates, right? Then people are going to say, hey, the Fed is so political. They're running out of time. What's your take?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I was myself hoping for a rate move back in September just so that we would get that behind us. But I think the global weakness is clearly what the Fed communicated that they were most concerned about. And of course, the absence of seeing strong evidence in the data that inflation has become a problem allowed them to kick that can even further down the road. But what we've been seeing, I believe, this summer is really a reflection of that global weakness. And one word probably describes what's been affecting the U.S. market in particular, and that's uncertainty. Because, again, while China is a major part of the world economy, its impact directly on the United States is actually relatively small. We don't send too many exports directly to China. Just the reverse. We actually buy quite a bit from China, and that's exactly why you see the trade deficit widening currently, because the strong dollar and the weakness there is essentially creating a scenario where consumers are really benefiting in the short term. But that uncertainty really has unrattled financial markets around the world. That provided essentially pressure to the Fed that even if the Fed had raised short-term rates, we likely wouldn't have seen a similar increase in long-term rates because globally that they're more reflective of what financial markets are doing. And it's that uncertainty, I think, that caused the declines and weaknesses and gyrations, huge gyrations in the stock market that started happening in July, continued and got even more severe in August and September. And I actually think that's the issue that has caused existing home sales and pending home sales to decline in August. And it's the impact of seeing suddenly your stock portfolio down 10% in 1 or 2 days.
It's a psychological thing, right? It's really psychological. People are looking at that and they're thinking, I'm not as wealthy as I was, so maybe I don't do anything. And certainly for millennials who should be jumping into the housing market, we already know and have talked ad nauseum about how they're just waiting to do everything, waiting to get married, waiting to buy a house, waiting to get a job, waiting to move out of mom and dad's house, whatever it is. I do want to ask you, though, about, when it comes to the global markets, we saw the weak start. This is going to air on Wednesday, so we're taping this Tuesday for Wednesday. But yesterday, Monday, We saw the stock market jump up again. It had, to your point, big gyrations. I had a conversation with some money managers last Thursday and Friday, people who probably together run tens of billions of dollars. One is a big guy, runs a lot of money for Morgan Stanley. Another guy who really, I think, is very interesting and was one of those people who called the 2007-2008 thing, bet against the market, made a fortune. These guys, there were five or six of them sitting on my stage, and we were running a discussion about what was going to happen. And to a person, none of them think we're in good shape. All of them, and there was a range here, so I want to describe the range. One guy is already buying gold. I mean, and not just like gold futures, not gold bricks. He's buying like smaller pieces of gold, which he plans to store in a mountain in either Switzerland or in Singapore. He hasn't decided yet. He thinks the world is ending tomorrow. And by that, I don't mean that we're all blowing up. I mean that the stock market and kind of the financial world, he thinks what happened in 08 is going to go a little bit further. On the far side, we had somebody who said, yeah, we're going to have a huge crash, but not for 18 months. That was the range I got from them. Are you hearing this sort of stuff from your cohorts economically?
No, I would say that those sound a bit to be outliers. But the funny thing is, the people that are very focused on the financial market seem to be where those perspectives are coming from. I've been attending several economic-oriented conferences lately, and I would say people in general are expecting continued gradual improvement. That's a bit of why the September job report was such a surprise. But I would say no one's really factoring in worldwide calamity. That does remain a risk.
Scenario.
I mean, you've got political uncertainty and problems that can completely destroy all models and how you're looking and forecasting the future. But a variety of factors within the U.S. Remain very resilient. One of them is demographics. We were at a point back when the financial crisis were happening where actually we would have probably seen some decline in housing regardless, because we were essentially dependent on the smallest generation, Generation X, which I'm a member of, to drive the housing market. And that generation is the smallest generation we have today. And the pure numbers just weren't in our favor for household formation and the kind of demand that you would see for robust housing. We're in an entirely different place today because we've got these two huge cohorts of the baby boomers all turning 55 by 2019, so being in those prime years for making retirement housing decisions and also having the most money that they're ever going to have. And at the same time, we have millennials exactly in that range where they should be buying homes. And indeed, we're starting to see that happen. But what you really see is that there's huge differences by market around the country. And you're really seeing that being driven by job creation, and it's attracting household formation and population. So there's some fundamental growth that's occurring here that we really didn't see back in 2007, 2008. So I don't think the level of risk is nearly as big. I'm just simply focused on if we wanted next year to be as strong as we've experienced this year, are all the factors pointing in that direction? And I would say the it looks like it's going to be good, but probably not as good next year as this year.
So bottom line, next year not as good as this year for real estate.
That's what if this job trend continues, and it's some very simple math. If you think about the job creation we've had, we had been averaging about 3 million jobs on a trailing 12-month basis. Guess what the household formation has been on a trailing four-quarter basis?
What?
1.6 million. And so the funny thing is, when I started in this business over 20 years ago, some very wise people said, hey, it's all about jobs. For every two jobs, you should have one household created. And we're seeing that exact math kind of play out. So if the job market isn't as robust, you won't see as much demand. And especially on the new construction side, I think you're going to continue to see only slow but gradual recovery.
And, of course, let's factor in the presidential election, where we all know from the 20 years I've been doing this that the 9 months preceding a presidential election, all real estate slows.
Yeah, there's a lot more uncertainty, a lot more of policy risk, a lot more questions about interest rates. And so,
and deductions. Yeah. What's going to happen to that deduction I'm counting on? You know, all the rest.
Yeah, and actually the funniest thing about all the gyrations we've had in August and September is that this consumer confidence actually increased in both of those months. And so there are truly a lot of puzzling metrics coming at us, and it looks like it's a bit bigger range of possibilities, let's say, that could be occurring not only through the end of this year but into next year, precisely because of all those things happening at once.
Well, we'll definitely have you back in about a month to talk about where we are as we get officially 1 month out, 1 year out from the presidential election. We're going to start doing a countdown, and we'll have you back to talk about where we are at that time. Jonathan Smoke is chief economist for Realtor.com. Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Elise.
On today's episode, I'm going to answer a question I received about when it may be worth adding your children's name to your house title and how that might affect the taxes that they pay. So a homeowner and mom of one recently wrote in to ask me the following question. I currently own a home that's paid in full with no mortgage. I want to add my daughter's name to the house deed. What are the pros and cons of this decision in terms of the taxes I'll pay or she will pay? Now, the short answer to the question is that adding your daughter's name or any child's name to your house title could have really serious repercussions when it comes time to sell the home. For federal income tax purposes, if you simply add your daughter's name to the title, she receives the house as a gift at your cost basis. The cost basis is a technical term, IRS jargon, on what it costs you to buy the property plus any material improvements you've made to the house along the way, like replacing the roof or replacing a bathroom, but not redecorating the living room. If you were selling, the cost basis would also include the cost of sale as well. So if you paid $100,000 for the property, say 20 years ago, and now the property is worth $500,000, wouldn't that be great? And you give your daughter half of the house, her cost basis would still be $50,000, or half of $100,000, which sounds like a great deal. And like all things financial, there are a few caveats. So when the property is eventually sold, right, your daughter would be entitled to take the first $250,000 in profits tax-free if she's single, up to $500,000 if she's married, and she lives in the property along with her spouse or partner as her primary residence. However, if she isn't living in the property when it's sold, she might have very significant capital gains taxes to pay. Now, if she inherits the other half from you, right, she would inherit the property at the current market value. So if you gave her half, right, that was the $50,000 of the $100,000, and she inherits the other half at $250,000, that's $300,000 as her cost basis. If she then immediately sells the property for $500,000 and she's living there as her primary residence, then she might not owe anything because $500,000 minus $300,000 is $200,000, and she's allowed to keep up to $250,000 tax-free. You can see how complicated this can be. And this mom, just like you, would want to talk to her tax preparer and her daughter's tax preparer to make sure she's handling this exactly the right way. The bigger issue for me is why so many people want to use quitclaim deeds to simply hand over control of the property. I think it really has something to do with probate or how control of assets change hands after a death. There are other ways, better ways, to deal with this rather than using a quitclaim deed to simply slap someone's name on the title and hand over property as a gift. You could use an inexpensive trust to make sure the property flows to your owner of choice after your death, while you still maintain control of the property while you're alive, just in case you need to sell the property and use that asset to support yourself. The very smartest thing you can do is talk with a real estate attorney or an estate attorney before you sign and file legal docs. Remember what I always say, read first twice, then sign. Five things you should do to increase the chances that your house will sell quickly. That should dramatically lower your stress level. Number one, make your yard a standout. This is such a huge opportunity. The vast majority of today's homebuyers start and sometimes end their search for a home online. Homes with yards that pop digitally garner a lot more clicks than yards that are messy or unkempt and have trash strewn about. You want your house to be gorgeous online. Number two, share the inside info with your neighbors. If you're selling your home, you should tell your neighbors first, really, even before listing your house, even before hiring an agent. Your neighbors presumably like living in your neighborhood. They like having you as a neighbor, and they may just know someone who's looking for a home like yours. Selling by word of mouth is such a huge win-win. You're going to sell more quickly, possibly for more money. You're going to save on the commission, while your neighbor will have a family member or friend living close by. That is such a huge win. Number three, have your minimum acceptable price in mind. It is so easy to get greedy. Greed is what happens when you say, I'll be okay with X, and then someone offers you X right off the bat. And then you're like, that's not good enough. But if you set a minimum acceptable price and write it down and post it right in front of you, the negotiations at least hit that, assuming you should be happy, right? To find out what a good price is, what a minimum acceptable price is, you should talk with at least three different real estate agents and ask each of them to prepare a comparative marketing analysis listing the homes similar to yours in your neighborhood that have sold in the last 6 months, including foreclosures. Understanding how foreclosures and short sales have impacted the pricing in your neighborhood will absolutely help you understand what kind of minimum price is advisable. Number four, don't rely on buyer's agents to tell your home's stories. When agents use a lockbox, you don't get a chance to tell the buyer about why you love your house. And by the way, I just read that now buyer's agents aren't even going to houses that have lockboxes on them. They are on their phones on Skype, and then they give the passwords to the lockbox to the buyers. So basically anybody could be coming through your house without the agent there. And there's all kinds of security issues around that. You should create, just in case this does happen, a list of the top features of your property alongside color photos of each feature and attach it to the listing sheet on the kitchen counter. While this may not sell your property in and of itself, if your agent won't be over to show the property, and by the way, I absolutely think he or she should, at least you've made an attempt at showcasing your home's greatest strengths. Remember, nobody loves your house as much as you do. You're the one to sell it. And I don't mean for sale by owner, but you're the one who has to point out all the best features. Here's the last thing, and I'm going to go back to greed. Don't get greedy. We're back to this green-eyed monster because it's so easy to get caught up in the emotional tug of war of home sale negotiations. I've been there. I've done it. I've gotten caught up in it, and I'm supposed to be the expert. Well, you may have that minimum acceptable price in your head. I'm telling you, the moment someone offers something close to that number, it'll be so tempting for you to ask for more. And you've got to resist that temptation. Instead, you've got to focus on how much above or below your sales price the initial offer is and figure out what it's going to take to close the deal. Because remember, nothing happens till the deal closes. Hey, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Thank you again to Jonathan Smoke for being on the show. Really, really interesting stuff, at least for me. Hope you enjoyed it too. If there was anything you missed, you never have to worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. But be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes if you haven't already, and please consider giving us a rating or review while you're there. You can search for The Elise Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes. You can also check out my other podcast, Monday Morning Marketing with Elise Glink and John Byrne, for some extra marketing, PR, and social media advice. These are all the tips of the trade that I have learned running a big digital content agency, ThinkLink Media. You can find us on iTunes. Be sure to give us a rating as well. Whew, that is the end of another episode of The Elise Glink Show. I have been delighted to hang out with you, and I'll be back next week with another episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Elise Glink. Have a great week.